sweet. And that's it for this week. So glad you could join me, and I hope you can join me again next week.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3, and studio production this morning was by Lyndon Jones. The music of the Baroque is the focal point at lunchtime today. The Venice Baroque Orchestra gave a concert recently in Vienna, and there to record it was the Early Music Show. Catherine Bott will be introducing the music at 1 o'clock. And an hour later, there's a chance to hear Kirill Karabits conducting the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra in music by Stravinsky and Beethoven, the Pulcinella Suite and the Fourth Symphony by Beethoven. And the tenor Mark Padmore will be singing Britain's song cycle, a setting of Rambo's poems of self-discovery, Les Illuminations. Our Sunday concert begins at 2 o'clock this afternoon. But now, with the time at midday, time on Radio 3 for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
A clue to the refreshingly individual tastes of Lucinda Lambton is easily found in the titles of her books and photographs: The Queen's Doll's House, Temples of Convenience and Chambers of Delight, An Album of Curious Houses, Palaces for Pigs, Beastly Buildings, Architecture for Animals. You may well indeed have seen her television series On the Throne, based on Temples of Convenience, a history of the lavatory. What brought you, do you think, Lucinda, to such maverick kind of subjects?
I suppose not having been educated, so having to jump in the deep end, whatever was there. And in the case of architecture, it was the Beamish Open Air Museum in County Durham, which was set up by a hero, still in our midst today, called Frank Atkinson, who ran the museum at Barnard Castle. And he realised that the culture of the northeast was dying and sent out a red alert to one and all throughout the county. And everything from a row of pitmen's teeth to a row of pitmen's cottages were bought and saved and set up in a model village, pit, street, towns, shops, everything. Everything was saved. The northeast was saved. The culture and the evidence of it was saved. And I photographed that and helped set it up. That's what began it all.
One of the things that you point out in your writing about the palatial buildings that have sometimes been built for pigs and horses and animals is, of course, that the owners could express their wildest dreams when the occupants were not in a position to talk back.
They went indeed. And there was a chance to build with unbridled enthusiasm in any old style you wanted, and at a relatively cheap price because it was a relatively small building. And so these buildings sprung up all over the land, and where there were pyramids for pigs, there was a pink castle for salmon, there was a tombstone, if you can believe it, to a trout, and a tombstone to a cow, and on it went.
Glorious. Faustina Gwynn was her name.
Yes.
And on the gravestone, it actually says, Faustina Gwynn, a cow, died aged 22.
Yes, and she was of such bovine excellence, according to the vicar, that she deserved a volume all of her own. And there it was, with all her ancestors, all her descendants, an enormous book written by a vicar in the 1850s. So hooray for that.
Now, we could easily talk for the next hour about this and animals and their, not to mention lavatories, of course, but we ought to get in a word about music here and there. And I'm wondering if that's always been something that you've been keen on.
It's a curious thing, and I'm a fraud, in fact, sitting in front of you, because I never listen to classical music because it so profoundly affects me. And it's so gougingly deep, gouging me inside out, and so all enveloping and annihilates all else, that without embracing it as a full working life, I would do nothing at all. So I'd never listen to it. And if I do listen to it, sure enough, I'm there for the day, for the week, embraced and lost in these swathes of musicality. So it's a useless, I don't listen to it nearly enough to be warrant sitting on this excellent programme.
Well, I think we're going to have to carry you out of the door feet first by the time we've been through this wonderful list. And it begins with, I think, a childhood memory, basically.
It begins with my mother's rare sortie into classical music. Her usual mode of listening to music was to bear a portable jukebox around with her, which you had to put money in, and which blared out a full work portable jukebox with an arm and everything, and pop music was the order of the day in that. But she played over and over and over again to me the Brandenburg concertos, so much so that I could sing them all the way through, and obviously did, because it takes me straight back to an orchard, a sunlit orchard in County Durham, and I can see the daffodils. Immediately I think, say the word Brandenburg, I'm there in County Durham, and when the music comes, I'm there walking through this sunlit orchard, deep in daffodils, and singing note for note the Brandenburg concerto. So it's a deep, yeah, it's a deep and old memory, yes.
Thank you.
always get a sense that it is a successful attempt at mathematics, my only attempt at mathematics, feeling that somehow you're listening to an infinite sum of subtractions, minuses and multiplications, and ending in resounding success, which of course I've never had. Always had that thrilling feeling of it being satisfactorily mathematical.
That was the Brandenburg Concerto No. 6 in B-flat by Bach, the third movement, the Allegro, with the Academy of Ancient Music directed by Christopher Hogwood. The battle hymn of the Republic next, Lucinda Lanton.
Most particularly this version. It is almost contemporary with the American Civil War, as the recording was made by a man who was born only 18 years after the Civil War had ended. I like the idea that it was a hymn, originally, written by a man called William Steth, saying, "So, brothers, will you meet me on Canaan's happy shore?" And then it became a camp song with John Brown's body and so on, as we know. And then the sensational Julia Ward Howe, who wrote these immortal words in the middle of the night. She'd seen the campfire outside Washington preparing for battle, and she had gone to bed, and the words had come to her in the middle of the night, and she wrote that she got up and, as was my wont when the children were asleep, committed the words that would not leave my head to paper with a stump of pencil. I went back to bed knowing that it was a job well done. So she wrote these sensationally moving and beautiful words in the middle of the night, in the dark, with a stub of pencil, and to hear them is to be stirred to the roots of your boots.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is tramping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His troop is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His troop is marching on. Fires of 100 circling camps, they have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damp. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamp. His day is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Born across the sea, with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Hallelujah, while God is marching on.
It is a good performance, isn't
wonderful,
it?
Yeah. So wonderful. And it really hailing from the past in a most extraordinary, evocative way. It's a live proclamation from the past.
We heard the Battle Hymn of the Republic in a 1917 recording with Reinald Werenrath and Joseph Pasternak conducting. The next composer takes us very nicely into your interest in lavatories. Do you know why?
No, I've no idea.
Well, Mozart, for all his genius, while he was writing on the one hand Marriage of Figaro and Così fan tutte, his letters revealed a kind of adolescent joy in farting and bottoms and lavatorial humour.
How funny, well done, how suitable.
What made you suddenly, was it like rather like with the palaces for animals, that you were rather fascinated by the history of...
I'm always fascinated by the history. I'm fascinated also, but the here example, all the also history surrounding each bit of music also fascinates me. In the case of the lavatories, it was when having a drink in the Philharmonic public house in Liverpool, somebody said, you ought to go and see the gents, they're made of red marble. And I went in and there they were, and in a terrible state. And I realised that they had to be recorded before it was too late. It wasn't red marble, it was the pattern of marble put on by ladies in white gloves and sponges they put on the paint. And I realised they had to be recorded before it was too late. And sure enough, all over the country there were hundreds of them that were... Britain, after all, ruled the sanitary waves in the late 19th century when they invented the lavatories, and the first public lavatories were here. So it was an important element of English history and architecture, I suppose, because they were beautiful little... They were little temples of convenience and also designed. So I'm glad to say I did record it, and a great many of them have gone.
But it's nice to think, isn't it, Lucinda Lambton, that for all your admiration for Mozart... here is an instance where he'd have had great admiration for you.
Oh, good, yes. I'm very, very glad to be on the plinth above Mozart.
What is it of his that you've chosen?
I've chosen Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. It was a French folk song, in fact, of the mid-1700s, and it had been used for lots of other children's songs, and he did variations on it. Now, I want you to tell me why the convolutions of variations are so thrilling. I liken it to wrestling with something so delicate, so you never know where you are, because it's a real wrestle, yet with dainty, dainty, dainty delicacy. But I'd like you to tell me why it's exciting to hear variations. It always is. La ci la dem la mano, another one that comes into my mind. It's always exciting.
Well, I think why it's intellectually and emotionally satisfying is that you can relate to the tune that started it in the first place.
And you can hear
it. So you can hear it being taken for a walk, to use a famous term.
Listening to it, you trace it, don't you? You trace its root, and then you see it developing out, rather like a tree, in fact, growing fast.
It's the organic nature of variation.
Oh, yes, so it is. Thank you. That's a good thing. Pleasing, but better than pleasing. It's
satisfying.
Better than that. It's sort of torturous. You feel yourself like pulling, as if you didn't have gloves on, but could pull your hand or body inside out. It's strangely torturous.
Thank you.
you can hear the structure of it so easily listening to it, and that marvellous thing of the central core being there and his lovely flowers sprouting off it. It's so satisfying to be able to see it, hear it so clearly.
Clara Haskell played Mozart's variations on Ah, vous dirai-je, maman, Kirkel 265. Now, you have decided on one concession to Romanticism, Lucinda Lambton.
Not one concession at all. I'd have the whole bang lot, but how can we...
So what? No, okay. So there's a representative of the Romantic movement.
It's a representative of the Romantic movement with such heroes standing in force, such as Rossini and Hummel and Schubert and Bellini and Berlioz, all of them thundering through the very fibres of my being all the time when I allow them to, very thoroughly and completely. But we can't have them all because we're not going to be here all day, sadly. So Weber can stand in for the lot of them, but he's not necessarily, I'd say, the best. It's just for me in particular, this tune, one of the first records I bought when I was 17, and it makes me, I think of the golden horizons ahead. Debussy said a very thrilling thing about him, which was he scrutinised the soul of each instrument. Isn't that pleasing?
So it's the overture to Oberon.
It's the overture to Oberon, which is based on this great romantic epic poem about a French knight called Huon de Bordeaux, and a marvellous sort of fairy story of Huon having to wrest the emir of Babylon's hair from his head and his teeth from his mouth. William Southby, he translated it from German into English, and he said, "The thunder of the trumpet and the clash of arms must have silenced the voice of the muses. Would that I were possessed of the fairy horn which the wood god gave to Huon, that I might gently breathe enchanting melodies over the perturbed world and convert military manoeuvres to a bloodless dance."
Well, that was the overture to Oberon by Weber, Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. America once more.
America once more. America occupies the very core of my being. I call my son Huckleberry, and 32 years after he was born, I had a letter from a man in Mississippi saying, did I know that Mark Twain's mother was a Lambton? And I had no idea, and I went to Mississippi, as I happened to be going there anyway, in my elevated position as the British sanitary advisor for the American Sanitary Plumbing Museum. And I went to Mississippi and was told that Mark Twain's mother was indeed a Lambton, and that her first cousin had fled hearth and home and gone down the Mississippi on a flatboat and was the basis of Huckleberry Finn. So Huckleberry Finn was a Lambton. I'd called my son Huckleberry 32 years before, and I went to, introduced to the grave of William Lambton, who was buried between his wife Lucy Lambton and his daughter Lucinda Lambton. So that showed me that my roots were dug deep in that great land. And I've chosen America the Beautiful because it again stirs my heart quite out of my body. But and I like very much that it was written by an English professor at Wellesley College, and she stood on Pike's Peak, Colorado Springs, and I went and stood there and sung, "Oh beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, looking down, I'm afraid, on car dealerships as far as the eye could see, with glinting bonnets and glinting cars as far as the eye could see." But there it was, that beautiful song written in 1893 and sung by Ray Charles, hailing Obama from 1959, the man who sung it so well and so beautifully.
Oh, beautiful, far spacious skies, far amber waves of grain. A purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain. Well, now, wait a minute. I'm talking about America, sweet America. You know, God done shed his grace on thee. He gave me crown like good. Yes, he did. Heavy brotherhood from sea to shining sea. You know, I wish I had somebody to help me sing this.
America the Beautiful, lyrics by Catherine Lee Bates, music by Samuel A. Ward, and we heard Ray Charles. Music from Offenbach next, but I think there's a strong filmic connection for you here, Lucinda.
Very much so. I mean, no better thing could have been enjoyed by a little girl than to see the Tales of Hoffmann, Paul Pressburger's Tales of Hoffmann, with Moira Sherida dancing and with Dr. Miracle, the frightening helpman, as Robert Helpman as Dr. Miracle, making the consumptive Antonia sing to her death. And in the case, the one I've chosen is Les Oiseaux dans la Chaumie, which was danced by Moira Sherida and sung by a woman called Dorothy Bond. She was a doll who he, with magic spectacles, believed to be a true dancing woman. And every now and again she'd collapse and have to be wound up with a cranking key and dance off again in a perfectly extraordinary way. And I found a wonderful letter from Cecil B. DeMille to Paul Pressburger, who said, "For the first time in my life, I was treated to grand opera, where the beauty, power, scope of the music was equally matched by the visual presentation. I thank you for outstanding courage and artistry in bringing to us grand opera, as it existed until now, only in the minds of those who created it." And it was those extraordinary sets and the extraordinary full whack opulence. Credit where credit's due, the sets were designed by a man called Hein Heckroth, and he did Red Shoes and all those films, where they're extraordinary surrealist sets. Marvellous.
Oh,
Les Oiseaux dans la Charmille, from the Tales of Hoffmann, Act One by Offenbach, and we heard Joan Sutherland singing Olympia. That was from the recording with the Orchestra of the Suisse Romande, conducted by Richard Bonning, and we heard very briefly Jacques Charon as Spallanzani, doubtless winding her up.
Yes, so lovely, that crinking down, and Moira Scher was so marvellously limp as she sunk into doll-like death and then was wound up again, cranked up into life.
The soloist in our next piece, Lucinda Lambton, you knew and had a rather interesting conversation with, I think.
Hugh de Menuhin, yes. I'm a friend of his daughter's, but the extraordinary memory I have of is talking to him with passion on his part about the future of the electric car. And he told me a really bewitching story that must have taken place. I mean, he was born in San Francisco, yes, in 1916, so this was when he was a small child, and he told me how he'd first seen the electric car when he was a small child in the steep streets of San Francisco, and every day a lady would go past in a tiny violet, he called it, violet-coloured vehicle with violet lace curtains and a lady sitting inside with a violet hat at an angle. And she would lift the curtains and wave at this little boy as he ran up. It's a really haunting picture, isn't it? And he was so delighted by this every day, this old lady in her car. She would be drawing the curtains aside to wave. And thereafter, he was always experimenting and doing what he could to bring it forward, the movement for the electric car, until he died.
It's Paganini that he is playing. And actually, Paganini repeatedly sold his soul to the devil.
He looked as if he had.
Menuhin never looked like that.
No. He was very, very benign.
Quite the reverse, in fact. Yes. Something rather saintly about his demeanour.
Yes, indeed there was. And about his music, something heavenly about his music too, wasn't there?
And why this piece in particular, the Paganini?
Well, it does transport me back to a period when I met two architectural historians who were to play an enormous part in my life. I eventually was to have romances with them both over the years. And this was the heralding of a new dawn with this music. And because the fellow was going to Heathrow that first day when my heart was kindled, annoyingly enough, marching in with Paganini's exquisite notes, it's always Heathrow there in all its lump and 60s glory. So that's a real shame that pierced through with the intensity of the music. It's also clumping in with Heathrow.
Thank you.
part of the third movement, the Rondo Allegro Spiritoso from Paganini's Violin Concerto No. 1 in D, Yehudi Menuhin playing with the Paris Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the great Pierre Monteur. I think we're going to finish, Lucinda, with something which we've definitely not had on the programme before.
Hooray! It is the Cajun music played by the Savoie Cajun family band from Louisiana. It's a very extraordinary history because you can hear it wailing out of the music once you know that the Cajuns emigrated from Poitou and various other places in France in the late 16th and early 17th century, and they went to Canada, where they set up a great colony. And then the English won the colony from the French. They were banished in no uncertain terms, banished out to sea, all their houses burnt, and went down the eastern seaboard until they found a home in New Orleans, where the French aristocracy looked down at them, and they went inland to the bayous of Louisiana, where they've lived to this day, and still sing and play fiddles and a wail. It's wailing from the past. You can hear the centuries going along with this extraordinary, very complicated structures as well, and they're full of half tones, and there are what's called bridges, which are alternate tunes on the go at the same time, and yet when all these tunes are going at once, there are even more frills are added, and these haunting voices and violins from, as I say, 17th century France mixed with 18th century Canada swept into the 19th and 20th and 21st century Louisiana. This is a particular wailing number. It's called J'ai passé devant ta porte, as it is the singer's outside his beloved's house, seeing her through the window in her coffin, in his coffin, lit by candles.
Chandelle allumée tout dans ce cœur. C'est là que j'ai vu, toi t'étais mort. Oh, y'a mon cœur fait mal.
What did you think of it?
I saw all of those things you were talking about mixed in. The Savoy Family Cajun Band, J'ai passé devant ta porte. And are you writing something at this minute?
Yes, Buildings of the Caribbean. I saw first the keystone over the prison door in Antigua said G the second R, 1732, and I realised there was a whole substrata of English buildings in the Caribbean that were largely ignored because of the association with slavery. And there they all are, splendid and extraordinary great Palladian buildings in ruins.
Well, long may you uncover these treasures for us. Lucinda Lambton, thank you very much.
Thank you, gosh.
Lucinda Lambton was talking to Michael Barclay, and there's no edition of Private Passions next week. More about that in a moment. But on Sunday the 30th of October, Michael's guest will be Trevor Phillips, the chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall. Well, now here's Andrew McGregor with what is happening next Sunday.
On BBC Radio 3 for Franz Liszt's bicentenary year. A whole day of Liszt's music in concert from across the European Broadcasting Union. The BBC singers in London with some of Liszt's music for choir. His mighty oratorio Christus from Budapest. The Faust Symphony from Liszt's adopted city of Weimar. A live concert from the city where he spent his final years, Bayreuth. A celebration of Franz Liszt. Next Sunday from 12 noon on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3 is on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Ian Skelly.
The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has rejected suggestions that the former Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, tried to pursue an independent foreign policy under the influence of lobbyists. Dr. Fox resigned on Friday amid allegations about his working relationship with a friend and self-styled adviser, Adam Werity. Mr. Hague said he himself was responsible for directing foreign policy with the help of the Prime Minister and 140 ambassadors around the world. Israel has begun the process of releasing nearly 500 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. He was seized by militants in Gaza in 2006. The prisoners now have been named and are being gathered in two prisons ahead of their expected pardon and release on Tuesday. Tens of thousands of anti-government protesters in Yemen are holding another mass rally in the capital Sana'a. That's a day after at least 12 people were killed when security forces opened fire. Witnesses say there's been more violence with 4 more deaths. Many others have also been wounded. Protesters who've set up camp in the city of London calling for changes to the global financial system say they intend to stay for weeks. The protest, which began last night, coincided with similar action in cities around the world. The demonstrators in London have erected 70 tents outside St Paul's Cathedral. Thousands of people have lined the streets of the Wiltshire town of Wootton Bassett, which will formally receive a royal title this lunchtime. The Princess Royal will represent the Queen at the ceremony, which will include a celebration parade and flypast. The town became famous for its role in the repatriation of British armed forces who died in Iraq and Afghanistan. New Zealand is through to the final of the Rugby World Cup. The team beat Australia in Auckland this morning by 20-6. They'll meet France in the final on Sunday. And the weather, there'll be sunny spells in parts of England and Wales this afternoon. Elsewhere, though, it'll be breezy with scattered showers. Those showers will become heavy and frequent in the far northwest overnight. Elsewhere, it'll remain dry with clear spells. And that's the BBC News and the weather. The time just coming up to 1:03.
And that means it's time to join Catherine Bott for today's early music show, which features music performed by the Venice Baroque Orchestra. And the programme starts with a string sinfonia by Vivaldi.
Thank you. some very gutsy Vivaldi to begin the programme, from his 1740 serenata Il Coro delle Muse, the Sinfonia in G for strings and continuo RV149, played by the Venice Baroque Orchestra, conducted by Andrea Marcon. In today's early music show, highlights from a concert they gave last February, recorded in the Konzerthaus in Vienna and made available to us by courtesy of our colleagues at the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation via the European Broadcasting Union. The Venice Baroque Orchestra was founded in 1997 by the organist and harpsichordist Andrea Marcon, a graduate of the Schola Cantorum in Basel, and they've chalked up a number of baroque operatic firsts over the last 14 years, including modern premieres of Cavalli's L'Orione, Handel's Siroe, and two versions of L'Olimpiade by Cimarosa and Galuppi. So, an ensemble that's very experienced in accompanying singers. And for this concert, Marcon and his players were joined by a remarkable French soprano, whose voice is designed to obey all the commands of her intense and thrilling histrionic instincts, Patricia Petitbon. She's recorded a CD with the orchestra, which offers glimpses of some of Baroque music's most compelling female characters, and we're going to hear from two of them right away. First, an aria from Alessandro Stradella's oratorio San Giovanni Battista, written in 1675 and astonishingly advanced in its quirky decadence. Patricia Petitbon is the incarnation of pathos as King Herod's daughter, but remember,